Esther chapter 6. Midway in the book of Esther, we've had the crisis building up through five chapters, and we are now at the midpoint, second half of the book of Esther. Crisis over rule. Crisis over rule, chapter 6, verse 1 through the end of the book, chapter 10 and verse 3. And tonight we will look at chapter 6 and chapter 7. Chapter 6 has to do with the humiliation of Haman. And then in chapter 7 we'll have the destruction of Haman. Haman has to be dealt with because this is the man, remember, that hates Jews so badly. He has gotten out the edict that every Jew is to be killed. It's all imminent. It's all about to happen. And now, with his success coming up through chapter 5, his elevation, his success with the edict, we're now ready to take the downhill run as far as Haman is concerned. Chapter 6, entire chapter, verses 1 through 14. And that, in turn, will break down into parts. And part 1 is the discovery in the diary. Esther 6, 1 through 5. The king's discovery in the diary. 6, 1 through 5. As we come up to chapter 6, Esther has been asked twice what favor she would like of the king. She has delayed it, she has put it off, and now she's ready for her second banquet. And on the night before the second banquet, Xerxes could not sleep. So chapter 6, verse 1 begins, "During that night, just preceding the banquet with Esther, the king Xerxes could not sleep, so he gave an order to bring the book of records, the chronicles, and they were read before the king." So essentially he says, "I cannot sleep, bring in the annals of the kingdom and have them read to me." The name of the books is translated various ways. In chapter 6, verse 1, it's called Book of the Records. Book of the Records, if you're using New American Standard Version. If we would translate the Hebrew literally, it can be one of two ways. The Book of Remembrances. The Book of Things to be Remembered. Book of Remembrances. Or it can also be translated Book of Matters of the Day. And that's why our word diary is a good translation. If we're looking at NIV, NIV is a little bit more obscure. I believe it says Book of the Chronicles. NASB, Book of the Records. New English Bible. Does anyone have the New English Bible? It comes across real well. Chronicle of Daily Events. The essence of it is it was an official record of daily events in the kingdom. And it's for that book that the king calls. He says, "Let me review what's been going on in the kingdom." And you can imagine the length of those records, keeping a daily diary of things that would happen in a government of that size or an empire of that size. And so I think it's important to recognize that we're looking at volume after volume after volume after volume after volume. I had someone call from Florida, a seminary student this week, and said for a friend he wanted to buy him a copy of the Talmud. And I said, "Well, that's a big thing to bite off. The Talmud comes in about 48 thick books, and it is probably the most boring reading you will ever do in all of your life." And this was doubtless the same thing. So don't think, when we mention diary, what do you think? One of these little things with a hook on it that has got a crummy key that won't keep anybody out. Don't think that. This is a large historical record. The reason for saying that is the chance of his hitting on the events of one day that pertained to Mordecai were out of sight. Even if this man every night spent 4 hours reading in the diary of the kingdom, it's unlikely, if he did it random, it's unlikely that he would ever come across, at least very soon come across, a record of one day when Mordecai reported a single event on a single day. So not only is it providential that he has the book brought to him, it's also providential that he came to the right place, namely the place where the event about Mordecai has been read. So basically then, with the discovery in the diary, we need to note that Esther 6 is a series of trivial events. Very trivial events that God makes significant. And they become significant under the sovereign and the providential hand of the Lord. And therefore, what we're going to have is the edict is about to be fulfilled to kill all the Jews, and this little series of events, getting the right book, turning to the right page, not being able to sleep, and all of these things will come together to literally overrule Haman. And so this is really, if we'd continue our title for chapter 6, it is the humiliation of Haman via insignificant events controlled by a sovereign God. And that is what happens in this particular section. Now, we mentioned that the crisis is the extermination of the Jews. But we've got to remember that every crisis has a sub-crisis. Maybe I should say sub-crises. And chapter 6 is looking at a sub-crisis. And the sub-crisis, well, let's put down the crisis and sub-crisis. Crisis is annihilation of the Jews. That's the crisis. But part of that sub-crisis is the fate of Mordecai. And he's about to be hanged the next day. So you have this major event coming up. But before the major event takes place, Mordecai is going to get hanged. So chapter 6 comes in and gives us that particular sub-crisis. In other words, if something is to be done for Mordecai, it's got to be done now. And it has to proceed and go before what is going to happen to the Jews later. That again points out that not only are the providential events in Esther under the hand of God, but the timing is also under the hand of God in the same way. Now, coming into this, did we read all the way through? We didn't, did we? Let's go down to verse 2. Now, there are going to be two events here that miraculously happen at the same time. The king cannot sleep. It was found written what Mordecai had reported concerning Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who were doorkeepers, that they had thought to lay hands on King Xerxes. And the king said, "What honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" Then the king's servants who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." Now please notice the timing here, because it's significant. In the first place, the king can't sleep. He calls for the diary. He opens to the right place. He reads about Mordecai. He asks a question, "What's been done for him?" Well, Haman couldn't sleep. And the reason Haman couldn't sleep was probably manifold. In the first place, he is so excited that he's going to dine with Esther and the king the next day that he's anticipation of it. And not only is this true, but he's got this gallows built on which Mordecai is going to hang. And if Mordecai doesn't hang on the gallows, he won't be happy at the banquet. But at the same time, he has to get permission to get Mordecai hanged. So that night, he apparently gets up early because he was excited. He gets up early because he needed to get approval of the gallows, and he hurries over to the palace of Xerxes, and he's there early. Xerxes figures probably nobody is out there this time of day, and thus, just as he reads about Mordecai, asks the question, verse 4. So the king said, "Who is in the court?" Now, of all things, Haman had just entered the outer court. So if you can see the scenario, the king's in bed, he's reading. Has anything been done for Mordecai? Who's in the court? And in walks Haman. Of his own choice, of his own volition, of his own excitement. He comes in, but notice they're providentially worked together, and that again points to the sovereignty of God. Now, when you come down to the question about what dignity has been done for Mordecai, this was not just a matter of courtesy or not just a matter of thanksgiving. Reward of benefactors was a matter of honor with a Persian king. In other words, if a Persian king had a favor done for him and he did not honor that in some way, his honor was at stake. And so it was not just a matter of thankfulness. It was not just a matter of courtesy. It wasn't just a matter of beauty. It was a matter of honor that entered into the picture. Thus, we move from the discovery in the diary, and now we have to put on display Mordecai. Display of Mordecai. 6 through 11. Discovery and now display of Mordecai. Verses 6 through 11. One of the interesting things about the book of Esther that begins to work in is not only the way God is able to work events together to bring about his plan, but the book of Esther is also an excellent example of reversals. An excellent example of reversals. And what we mean is this. We will sort of chart this out, and we will look at what somebody planned as over against what happened. And when you compare the two together, you find out that what was planned was reversed by what happened. And you will have, well, let's put it this way, example of reversals, or planning reversed by providence. Planning reversed by providence. Now, when we come to planning reversed by providence, you come very close to a figure of speech that we've got in English called irony. Irony means what all the facts indicate is going to happen didn't happen. And we'll come to a key section of irony in this section. But let's kind of chart this, and we'll put over on the left Haman's plan. Chapter 5, verse 14. Zeresh, his wife, and his friends said to him, "Have a gallows 50 cubits high made in the morning, and ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it." Notice this was not his option. This would have to be at the ruling of the king. So the plan was bring the law against Mordecai. That's the plan. Bring the law against Mordecai, 5:14. Get the king to rule against him. Chapter 6 and verse 10. The providential reversal of that was to bring the law for Mordecai. 6:10. The human plan is work a law against him. The divine overruling is bring a plan for him. And the contrast is man plans against, God plans for. And in chapter 6, verse 12, verse 10, and this is such a reversal of Haman's plans, this is something he really didn't plan on doing. Said the king said to Haman, "Take quickly the robes, the horse, as you have said, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who is sitting in the king's gate. Do not fall short of anything of all you have said." And Mordecai has, rather, Haman has recommended, if you want to honor a man, put the robe on him, saddle him up in the king's horse, and all of that is going to be to humiliate Mordecai, and providence works things out, so Haman is humiliated, and Mordecai is honored. Second, the honor, the destruction, the plan of Haman was to destroy Mordecai. 5:14, very clear. We're going to hang him. Providence reversed that so that all things worked out to honor Mordecai. 6:11, honor him. 5:14, destroy him. You might notice, by the way, just in our vocabulary, the way something like this is interpreted goes this way for the Christian and that way for the unbeliever. Because the unbeliever would look at that and say, how, what are the words we use? Fortuitous. How lucky he was. And therefore, we have a whole vocabulary that omits God. And thus, that would not be seen. But it's very obvious for a Christian who believes that God is truly sovereign, as his word says he is, these things become very obvious that the hand of God is involved in it. One of the things that had also bothered Haman is, as long as Mordecai is around, this wonderful banquet coming up the next day, I can't enjoy it. And therefore, his whole point in 5:14 was to be able to attend the banquet with joy. If we go back, chapter 5, verse 12, he is bragging that only Esther has asked him, along with the king, to come to the banquet. And yet, verse 13, all this does not satisfy me every time I see Mordecai the Jew sitting in the king's gate. Then Zeresh and his wife and all his friends said to me, have a gallows 50 cubits made in the morning. Ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go joyfully with the king to the banquet. So the whole attempt was to set up a little program that would cause him to attend with joy. If you come down, however, to chapter 6 and verse 12, after honoring Mordecai, it says, verse 12, Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried home, mourning with his head covered. He wanted to attend with joy, and instead he attended with sorrow. On the left is the plan. On the right is providence. On the left is Haman. On the right is God. His plan, back again, fourth point, was to be exalted by the king. Chapter 6, verse 6. The king calls a man and he says, how can I honor a man that I really want to honor? And of course, for someone like Haman, there's only one way Haman's mind can go. Only person that the king would love enough to honor would be the only person that Haman knows that is worth loving. And that's obvious in a proud person who that is. It's got to be me. So the king said, verse 6. So Haman came in, and the king said to him, what is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor? And, of course, ego can go only one way. There can't be two options. There's only got to be one. I've got to be who he has in mind. And Haman said to himself, whom would the king desire to honor more than me? Then Haman said to the king, and he puts it on thick, for the man whom the king desires to honor, let him bring a royal robe which the king has worn. Let the horse on which the king has ridden, on whose head a royal crown has been placed, the royal crown went on the horse's head. Many of your inscriptions are found in festive occasions of honor, and you see the inscription with a decoration on the head of the horse. So verse 9, let the robe and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble princes. Let them array the man whom the king desires to honor, lead him on horseback, etc., etc. And Haman was convinced, I'm going to be that man. He went to be exalted. That's the plan of man. He ended up getting something other than exaltation. He got lifted up, but in a different way. And thus you come to 7:10. So they hanged Haman on the gallows which he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. He went to be exalted. That's his plan. And he ended up going to be hanged. Now, when we look down at these verses, you have one of the most ironical features of Esther coming down to chapter 6 where we've just read. The verses again we've just read. How do we honor the man? But let's put down a little bit of what do we mean? And we recognize that certain events can occur, and we call them ironical events. An ironical event is this. It is where the result is opposite of what was expected. The result is opposite of what is expected. Webster's big dictionary gives an excellent example of irony, where what you would expect, the opposite happens, and Webster gives one sentence. The fireboat burned and sank. And you wouldn't expect that of a fireboat designed to put out fires, but the irony of it all is what you would expect, that it would put out fires, it itself burns and sinks. And in this 6 through 9, this is the last thing in the world that Haman would have expected to happen, but it does. So we go to the last part of 6, display now of Mordecai, honored through the city, and now 3, the downfall of Haman. The downfall of Haman is in verses 12 and 13. I have searched and searched for an answer to the question that needs to be asked in verses 12 and 13, and I see what's there. But I don't know exactly how to explain how it got there, but let's read it. Chapter 6, verse 12. After honoring Mordecai, Mordecai returns to the king's gate. Haman hurried home, mourning, with his head covered. And Haman recounted to Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and Zeresh, his wife, said to him, If Mordecai, before you have begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. So I'll simply note here that it is obvious something special was seen in the Jewish people. And that something special was simply the idea that it seems like these people have a remarkable survivability. They have a remarkable ability to survive. Now, how did they know that? I don't know. You can give some options. It could have been perhaps acquaintance with victories under Joshua. They had some significant ones. That could have been where they got it. We're not really told, but we do know that it is very clearly there. And thus, he is told of his fate, and we conclude chapter 6. Now, let's put some observations down. Having gotten the history, what can we observe in chapter 6? Observations. 1. God may select any event. Emphasis on any event. God may select any event as a tool to effect his plan. God then is never in a place where he says, I'm rather limited. I can only use this or this. And we find ourselves in that situation where to get the plan done, we say, I've got to go this way, or maybe I could go this way, but we may have three options at the most. God never faces options. God can say, to affect my plan, I can use anything. And what that essentially means is when they put the decoration on the horse's head to lead Mordecai through the city, had God chosen, he could have said, that decoration on that horse's head is going to be used to be brought about my plan, to bring about my plan. That, of course, is because God is in control and God is sovereign in the earth. God is not limited by the insignificant or the little. We also have to note another thing here, that the providence, we'll just make it a sub-point here, providence is seen in retrospect, not prospect. Providence is seen in retrospect. And what we're saying is this, when it was learned that the king could not sleep, do you think Mordecai jumped up and down and said, oh, I see it. That's going to be the key to everything. He didn't. Didn't mean a thing to him. Just the king can't sleep. I'm glad I can. You don't see providence in prospect that is looking forward. We see it in retrospect as it is already worked out. Principle two, or observation number two. The providence of God covers timing as well as events. Providence covers timing as well as the event itself. Covers timing of the event as well as the event itself. Or let's put it a different way. God's providence covers the what, and it also covers the when. And for that, I'll simply refer back to, remember, the king couldn't sleep, the book's brought in, who's in the outer hall? There's Haman. So the king's inability to sleep, the reading of the book, the entry of Haman, the timing was literally perfect. So the pride of God, the providence of God is sovereign over timing, the when as well as the what. Third, important principle, down to verse 6 and verse 6. You may want to, ought to practice doing these things. Make your mind work in terms of read the text, then write an observation. What do you really see that's there? Verse 6, Haman came in, and the king said to him, what is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor? And Haman said to himself, whom would the king desire to honor more than me? And thus we have a principle or an observation is this. Self-centered mentality distorts reality. Self-centered mentality distorts reality. The reality of the case was, I'm going to honor Mordecai. And an ego, self-centered mentality, distorted that, so the reality that Mordecai was the man, Haman didn't see. Pride is insanity. Pride always ruins objectivity. And this is a good example of it in this particular. Think of pride. Pride is tunnel vision. Pride means you lost all your peripheral vision. You can't see to this side of it. You can only see down a tunnel one way, and that is inevitable with pride over and over and over again. Pride ruins ability to interpret events because we can't look at the event because of the nature of pride. Pride doesn't look at events. Pride looks at oneself. And so it's a self-distorting problem. Four. Pride, and we'll see this more in chapter 7, pride can be the inventor of one's own humiliation. Pride can be inventor of one's own humiliation. Who invented the humiliation of Haman? Haman did. And he did so by saying, the one that the king is going to honor is going to wear this, ride on this horse, and have this garment on, and be marched through the city. And as it all goes down, God writes it down. Okay, Haman, that's what you want to do. I'll let you create your own hell, your own humiliation. You can do it. And he does it in chapter 6, 7, and 9. Fifth, common language. And by common language, I mean the language that we hear all day long. Wherever we work or whatever we do, common language does not recognize the providence of God. Common language does not recognize providence. And I'll just jot down maybe three words. Fortuitous is sort of a way of saying it happened in a way that we do not wish to acknowledge God. Luck, happenstance, and all of that reflects the mentality of a man who has no place for God. Something happened that's obviously very unusual, very ironical. But we cannot say that's the hand of God. We must put it in the hand of, well, even personify it to what? Lady luck. And if God gets in the picture at all, it's not personal. It's the man upstairs, which is a very warm view of God. And something of that sort. So common language typically does not recognize providence. And a believer ought to watch that vocabulary because it does not really reflect proper mentality. Yes. Oh, okay. Yeah. That's right. That's right. There'll be I almost jumped ahead, so I don't want to do that. Okay. The plans of one's enemy, may be the plans for your delivery. Plans of one's enemy or enemies may be the plans used by God for your delivery. Probably a classic illustration of that. Let's turn to it. Genesis 50. And it's God's capability of reversing what some enemy had in mind and what happened in reality. Chapter 50 of Genesis 20:21. Haman planned Mordecai's death, which plan God used to give Mordecai life. It's a very relaxing mentality. We can take it. Joseph had it, as you might guess. Chapter 50, verse 20. Speaking to his brothers about their plan and the providence or sovereignty of God, he says, "And as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring about this present result to preserve many people alive." Can you see the principle? The plan of one's enemy may be the very plans that God will utilize for delivery. And the same thing happens here in Esther. All right, let's go back now to chapter 7. And we move from humiliation of Haman. And now we have the destruction of Haman. Justice is so strong here. God says, "I will not grant Haman a speedy death. I will make him squirm first." And chapter 6 of Esther is God making Haman squirm. And then we'll hang him after he's suffered a little bit. Very un-American, isn't it? But nonetheless, it's here. And we'll revolve this about several points. Number one, Esther is going to now be revealed. Seven, 1-4. And basically, you can get the gist of it by reading its narrative. The king and Haman came to drink wine with Esther, the queen. Haman's got to be feeling, well, it's pretty good right now. After all hospitality is genuine. Or can you see a principle rising? The king and Haman came to drink wine with Esther, the queen. And the king said to Esther on the second day, as they drank their wine at the banquet, "What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to the half of the kingdom it shall be done." And Queen Esther answered and said, "If I found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king," and let me give the Hebrew literally, "give me my life, comma, this is my petition. Give me my people, comma, this is my request." So notice two parts. Give me my life. This is my petition. Give me my people. This is my request. And in making that request, you get a little insight in verse 4 to what kind of character Xerxes must have been. Everybody seems to have to grovel at his feet. And she's going to say actually this: "If you had taken all of us Jews and made us slaves, we wouldn't have bothered you for a moment for that. But since it's a big request, like our life, we'll bother you for it." So verse 4. "For we have been sold," that'd be a reference to the price of Haman to put in the king's treasury to destroy Jews, "I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Now, if we'd only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with the annoyance to the king." Guys, wouldn't you like to get a setup like that? I mean, what a pampered person. I mean, if it's slavery for the rest of life, no big deal. I don't want to disturb your afternoon. But since it is life and death, may I have your ear for a moment, please? Must have been some despot. At any rate, she's very sensitive. She's revealed. And Haman is now going to be revealed. 1-4, Esther revealed. Now Haman revealed. 7, 5, and 6. Then King Xerxes asked Esther, "Who is he? Where is he that would presume to do thus?" It's a little strange. You mean Xerxes didn't know about the extermination of the Jewish people that was coming up? Sounds like he didn't know, doesn't he? And if you read chapter 3 real carefully, apparently Haman covered this from him. Because he never mentions Jews. Never mentions Jews. Go back to chapter 3 and notice his wording. And it explains why the king really doesn't know what's happening. It would be assumed, since we already know that Haman wants to exterminate the Jews, that Xerxes knew that. But notice when he first presented that, he didn't say a word in the world about Jews. Nothing. So chapter 3 and verse 8, Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from these of all other people, and they do not observe the king's laws. So it is not in the king's interest to let them remain. If it is pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed." And notice his wording very carefully avoids any mention of Jews. So, I take it then, in 5 and 6 of chapter 7, that this man has duped Xerxes. He's duped the king. And been able to do so by Xerxes simply saying, "Well, if there's a people out there, whoever they are, that are defiant with my laws, here's my signet ring, do ever what you want with them." And that probably explains chapter 6. Or chapter 7, rather, as to why he is not aware of this. Well, with that, Esther puts the finger on Haman. Esther said, verse 6, "A foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman. Then Haman became terrified. Became terrified doesn't even begin to get the Hebrew. It means he quaked. He shook. He became shaken, literally shaken, before the king and queen. So the king arose in his anger from drinking wine, went to the palace garden. Why did he get up and walk out? Well, maybe it was to think of a couple of reasons, can't you? Maybe it was to get alone to consider what an appropriate punishment would be. Or do you ever get in a situation where you're so mad you have to do what? Got to get out of the room and go to the bathroom or someplace and pull yourself together. Probably both of those. He was so angry. He goes out into the garden to think of what the punishment is going to be, probably. And also to get himself together and pull it together, perhaps too angry to speak. Well, this almost gets humorous. Haman is going to beg for his life. And it's got to be funny. The king goes out into the garden, and Haman says the only chance is the queen, and he falls at her feet, and he falls beside her on the couch, just in time for the king to walk in. Amazing, fortuitous chance. One thing for sure, this guy didn't have any luck. He's begging for his wife, and so verse 8, the king returned from the palace garden into the palace where they were drinking wine, and Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was, and the king explodes. The king said, will he even assault sexually the queen with me in my house? And as the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. And thus, we come down to the destruction of Esther revealed, Haman revealed, and now Haman hanged. I think we concluded last time by pointing out how absurd the gallows were. The gallows coming down to the end of chapter 7. Harbona remembers them and notes again that there are 50 cubits high. You don't necessarily have to picture a gallows 50 feet high. That measure could be, you know, from the top of a building. And he could have erected a 20-foot pole. But the point is, he wanted a public display for him to be seen. And, of course, he is going to be the one that's going to be displayed. All right, concluding in the last few minutes, Observations chapter 7. Observations chapter 7, 1. The punishment of the wicked, the punishment of the wicked, by his own machinations, punishment of the wicked by his own machinations is a principle of the Old Testament. So much is it a principle that it will often become a prayer. May the devisings and the plans of the wicked backfire on them. And it's not unusual for that to be prayed. So we look at three Psalms. Psalm 5:10. And we've come to a point that I can now ask this. Can you see any book that you've read anywhere in Scripture that has more of God in it without His name being plastered on every page? His whole working is there, and that's what we're to see. Just the principle of that, chapter 5 of the Psalms in verse 10. Hold them guilty, O God. By their own devices, let them fall. And we see that principle, and Haman built the gallows, and that was his machination, that was his plan, and it's through that
that he is judged. And notice the same principle, the same doctrine coming through here. So verse 10, hold them guilty, O God, by their own devices, let them fall. And notice it's a prayer. In the multitude of their transgressions, thrust them out, for they're rebellious against thee. Chapter 7 of Psalm, verse 15, 16. Psalm 7, 15, 16. This is the doctrine of how God lets man cook his goose. Doctrine of the cook goose. Chapter 7, verse 15. He has, speaking of the wicked, he's dug a pit. He's hollowed it out. He's fallen into the hole which he made. That was not the intent of the hole. The intent of the hole was for someone else to fall in it. But again, the Psalms love to see this kind of justice. Verse 16, his mischief will return upon his own head, and his violence will descend upon his own pate, his own toupee. Doesn't there have to be humor in that? Chapter 9, 15. So these are only samples. There are others, 9, 15, and 16. This is on a broader scope and showing that even the plans of a nation, we've had individuals before, but even the plans of a nation can be its own destruction. The nations have sunk down in a pit which they made, in the net which they hid. Their own foot has been caught. So notice, not only a principle, but it's a subject of prayer. 2. The success of the wicked is often great, but its end is not. Success of the wicked is great, but its end is not. Psalm 37, 36. Does anyone here, like I do, have Southern Baptist background? Do you remember R.G. Lee's famous sermon? Remember? Who said it, I think? Payday Someday. Remember in college, every student thought, man, what if you can memorize that sermon, you'll own the world. Only it didn't work for anybody except him. Psalm 37, 35. I've seen a violent, wicked man spreading himself like a luxuriant tree. And that's what we've had so far in the first five chapters with Haman. Successful, elevated, honored. Then verse 36, he passed away. And lo, he was no more. I sought for him and he could not be found. And Haman illustrates that principle quite well. Therefore, and this is a theme in Psalms, and we'll just write it out, it is ultimate folly, it is folly to envy the success of the wicked. It is folly to envy the success of evil men. Can't you believe that every man in the kingdom envied Haman when he was honored, but he was also evil. And so how foolish it was to envy the man who was honored, who ends up hanged and humiliated. 4. Evil plans, and we've touched on this, but let's do it again. Evil plans are a story, or our stories, get the tense right, evil plans are stories of reversals. just at the chapter we just completed. Days ago, everybody fell at Haman's feet. Now he falls at the feet of one woman. A few days ago, he hated Jews. And he's begging at the feet of whom? A Jewess. He proclaimed slaughter for every Jew. And now he's begging for his own life. Now let me give the fifth. Fifth. Esther 6:14-7:1. A principle off that. 6:14-7:1 shows how deceiving cordiality may be. Talks about the gathering at the banquet with Haman and Esther and Xerxes. They all drink wine together. It's all cordial, but it was all deceiving to Haman. How deceiving cordiality may be. Because as the queen and the king and Haman lift the glass, the queen says within a matter of moments, "There is the evil man." And what he thought was all cordiality, all everything nice, everything wonderful, turned out not to be. That's a practical matter. That's why I shouldn't do this, I guess, but when someone says, "Can I take you to lunch?" I always say to them, "What do you want to talk about? I mean, if you're taking me to lunch to set me straight, just do it without lunch, because it doesn't digest well when you're being set straight." Just like taking an employee out to lunch to fire them. How nice, you know. And that can shock a person for the rest of their life. They'll never go out with anybody because you think they're going to sell you Amway. 6. And I'll just put 6 is going to be a question at the end of chapter 7. And the question is this. And we're still facing it. The extermination of the Jews was in the law of the Medes and the Persians, which is irrevocable. How can the irrevocable law be sustained and deliver the Jews at the same time? And that's a problem. Now, can you see that foreshadowing or illustrating any other problem that's doctrinal in nature? How can the irrevocable law and justice of God be fully sustained and satisfied and at the same time save man? So when we come into chapter 8, which we'll do next time, we'll begin looking at that problem and we'll see a powerful illustration of how in the death of Christ the law of God is upheld, the justice of God is satisfied, His righteousness is sustained, and yet man can be saved. Father, we're thankful tonight for the book of Esther, for its lessons. We're thankful that the universe is not wildly spinning on its own way, but there is a God who is personal and living. And He is so in control, you are so in control, that even a yawn or an inability to sleep can be made significant by the God who makes all things and who controls history. In Christ's name.